home from work tired. And her little daughter said, "Mummy, are you going to meditation tonight?" And she said, "No, I'm too tired. I just want to relax." "Mummy, you must go to meditation tonight." "I don't want to go to meditation, darling." "Mummy, go to meditation tonight," said the daughter. "Why, darling," said the mother. "Because you're always a much nicer mummy when you come home from meditation." The little girl noticed that, and it's so true that, you know, if you really do the meditation properly, you're a much kinder, nicer person after meditating. And a similar story, to make sure it's gender equal, that we used to have these weekend retreats a long time ago regularly when we had to have another center to do them in. And there was this Australian man who always wanted to come on a meditation retreat, but his wife would never let him. No, he said, "Darling, there's a meditation retreat this weekend, can I go?" And she said, "What do you mean going? On the weekend we have to do the shopping, we have to take the children to sport, you have to fix up the garage, it's too busy. No, you can't go." So he said, "Okay, darling." But he kept on asking every retreat, "Can I go on a retreat this weekend?" "No, of course you can't come. Mother's coming. You know, we've got to fix up the gutters. You have to mow the lawn. There's too many things to do on a weekend. No, you can't go." And that was what it was many, many times. He kept asking his wife, but he was persistent. Until eventually one day his wife said, "Okay, you go on your retreat. You leave me with the kids and the housework and the shopping and everything." And so he did. He took that as a yes. And what happened next was, he told us afterwards, when he came home from that retreat, his wife saw that he was such a beautiful husband after he came back from a weekend meditation retreat, that from that time on he never needed to ask. She would always give him the money and send him off. And he came back home, new and improved husband. So if you have any husbands you want to be improved, send them to me for a weekend retreat. And when they go back to Indonesia or Hong Kong, they'll be new, improved, all nice and soft and easy to work with. So that's why you meditate. So it's probably good. Next one. "Dear Ajahn, thank you for ringing the singing bowl so well. The haunting..." Haunting? "But peaceful sounds permeates right through the whole body." Yeah, I prefer to, this was offered a long time ago, I prefer to do that than these bells you ring. Because, you know, sometimes you're getting so peaceful, and bang, and they ring this bell, and it's so noisy, and it just, you know, the bell rattles, and I rattle as well, you know, when the bell goes, and it's just so unpleasant, especially when you're very peaceful in meditation. So a little singing bell is a much nicer way to come out from the meditation than a big bang. So that's a much, thank you, I like ringing that one as well. "I understand we need to be kind and mindful to be still. How to establish mindfulness? Is it so difficult?" Of course it's not difficult. Life is never difficult when you get out of the way and you don't expect anything from life. It was in Singapore that somebody asked me, he said, "Ajahn Brahm, I know the Buddha talked about the Four Noble Truths. Can you please teach me the Four Noble Truths quickly, because I've got to go to an appointment. I've only got 1 minute." It actually happened. So I like being put on the spot like that, you know, when they sort of challenge you. And so I came up with something, and it actually was very good. I say, suffering is asking from the world what it can never give you. I quite like that. It's asking from this world something it can never give you. That's called suffering. So, as long as you don't ask for what's impossible, you'll always be peaceful and happy. Just like, you know, someone at the interview this afternoon, they've already had a beautiful nimitta, and they say, but the next time after they had a beautiful nimitta, they got nothing. Oh, come on, many of you, you give your right arm and leg for a nimitta, you haven't got anything at all. And they've got a nimitta and they're complaining. It doesn't come up all the time. So remember, just don't ask for anything in life, especially what it can't give you. And then everything is a gift. You can appreciate everything. When you are contented and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature, which we've just been chanting. Have you been listening to those chants, which we do? There's a lot of Dhamma in those. I like to tell people, if you listen to that chant very carefully, you can understand why it is that monks have big monasteries, but nuns, they have very small monasteries. Why all the donations go to the monks and hardly anything go to the nuns. You know why? Haven't you been listening? Whatever living beings there may be, omitting nuns. Let none deceive another. So that chanting, you understand why the nuns don't get anything. So I remember somebody noticed that, and so they decided to change that chant, the metta chant. Whatever living beings there may be, omitting monks, let monks deceive another, or despise any being in any state, let monks through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Just to make it fair. But no, to establish mindfulness. Mindfulness is not something you do to establish. It's just what happens when you relax and become still. It's one of the things which you will know. It doesn't matter how good you think you are at meditation. It doesn't matter just whether you think you've done a lot of meditation or a small amount of meditation on this retreat. You will begin to notice as the retreat, comes to its end. You are much more relaxed, more awake. Food tastes more delicious. You can enjoy the nature much more. And where you really do get a shock is when you leave this place. You don't realize how much you've slowed down, because we've all slowed down together. But when you go out, it's just really a shock, just how busy life is outside of this retreat center. You have calmed down and you have woken up. You have become much more mindful. But sometimes you don't recognize it. But eventually you realize by relaxing, resting, going slowly, not talking so much, not doing so much, your mindfulness increases. The more you do, the weaker is your mindfulness. Slower, the more still, the stronger the mindfulness. And that's how mindfulness gets established. Through stillness, through relaxation, not by doing things. Kindness makes you mindful. Mindful makes you kind. That's why we always say it's not mindfulness, it's kindfulness. Don't just be aware, be kind. If you don't know what I mean, I told this story, because I know that some of you have done Vipassana retreats before. And there was a story of this very, very rich woman in Jakarta who came to one of the temples for a talk one evening. And before she left her mansion, she told the guard at the gate of her mansion, "Be careful, because there's many burglaries have happened in this little neighborhood, and I don't want my mansion to be burgled while I'm out at the temple Vihara listening to a talk. So guard, I want you to be mindful tonight. Be very mindful." So she goes off to her talk at the Vihara. And when she returns home a couple of hours later, she finds her house has been burgled. And lots of things are missing. And she goes to the guard at the gate of her house. "You stupid guard, I told you to be mindful. I've been burgled. What happened?" And the guard said, "Madam, I was mindful all the time. I was mindful of the thieves going in the house. I noticed. Burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them coming out with your jewelry, and I noted jewelry going out, jewelry going out, jewelry going out. I saw them going in with the truck, truck going in, truck going in, truck going in. I saw them carrying your safe away in the back of the truck, and I was mindful, I noted safe going away, safe going away, safe going. I was mindful all the time, madam." Is that good enough? Mindfulness is not good enough. You have to be kind as well. Kind to your employee. You know, go and ring the police. Stop the thieves. Do something. Don't just be mindful and just watch the burglars go in and the burglars go out. That is not enough. Which is always why I say kindfulness is what we need. Be aware, yes, but be kind enough to do your duties and to create positive things in the world. Not just be aware and just let everything just fall apart. Please tell a story that teaches us how to be compassionate to people like the talking tortoise, noisy neighbours, people who leave messes everywhere, and how to appreciate the goodness in them. Now, what's a nice story how you can appreciate messy people? I'll just put that aside until one comes up, and then see if we can get one before the evening's out. Dear Ajahn, are you better than others? Are you worse than others? Are you the same as others? Now, I said the other day that I'm not allowed to tell one's attainments. You're trying to trick me, but I'm much smarter than that. Because I said the other day that this is how an arahat, a fully enlightened being, went to actually to tell the Buddha they were enlightened. They never said, I'm enlightened, look at me. I am fully enlightened. I am great. I am the best. No, never said that. He just always said, one who's enlightened never compares themselves with others, never thinks they're better, worse, or the same. That's an enlightened being. That's beautiful when you understand that, because it means that the whole purpose of this is not to try and be somebody, but for the sense of self and ego, me and mine, to vanish, disappear. So that's why I know sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're a senior monk now, how should we address you? And I have a couple of ways you can address me. One of them is your emptiness. I quite like that. Your emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. Not your holiness. Maybe your roundness, Ajahn Brahm, is my... Because this is actually what happens, is when a person gets more and more practice, they disappear. So you're not better, you're not worse, you're not the same. And there's no way I can get tricked into sort of saying if what I am, because I'm nothing. I'm a nobody. I'm hopeless. I always say that, you know, that monks, especially really good monks, they're losers. I'm a loser. I've lost all my money, I've lost all my hair, I've lost all my past and future, I've lost so much. And the biggest loser ever was the Buddha. So when someone comes up to me and says, you loser, you monks, you're losers. I say, yes, we're losers. Do you want to be a winner? If you become a winner, you get big ego and you have to win in the next contest as well. Well, there's no end in winning, but there's an end in losing. Peace at last, I've lost. Yes. The sooner you lose, the sooner you can go home and relax. I notice that with exams. As soon as you pass one exam, you've got to do another one next year. And then you pass that one, you do another one afterwards. Until at last you fail an exam. When you fail an exam, you're free. So I tell that to children, look, forget about your O-levels and A-levels. If you pass your O-levels, you have to do A-levels. If you pass your A-levels, you have to do a bachelor's degree. You do pass your bachelor's degree, you have to do a master's. You get your master's, you've got to do a PhD. It never ends. So fail at O-levels. If you fail at O-levels, you're free. You don't have to do any more work. It makes a lot of sense. Be a loser like me. Dear Ajahn Brahm, you are cordially invited to attend our mindfulness stretching exercise at Walking Meditation Room 1 p.m. daily. All Sangha invited too, so do all retreatants. They're doing a mindfulness stretching exercise. I don't know what that means. Is that you want to hang me from the neck and stretch me? Or take hold of my arms and legs and stretch me that way? I don't know what you're trying to do, but you're stretching a bit, trying to invite me. so I don't know. So I thank you for the invitation, but I politely decline. Or rather, no, I said yesterday, I should never decline an invitation, because people with very good hearts ask this invitation, and they're doing it for the best intentions at all. So no, I will not decline your invitation. I will think about it. But anyway, anyone who wants to do some stretching exercises, then that'd be very good, because it makes you be able to sit very easily. And I know it's very popular. Some women, they want to stretch their husband's neck. But we don't do those sorts of stretching here. Dear Ajahn, I watched a German documentary about the automatic brain. It said that decision-making is just a delusion. The brain makes all the decisions by itself without informing us 99.99% of the times. Is this what you mean by the bus without a driver? So what affects our actions, our daily habits, daily influences? How do we change the course of our lives towards enlightenment if there's no driver on the bus? Thanks a lot. Now that's a very, very deep, good question. The driverless bus simile, if you haven't seen that one, it's in my books and one of my inventions. I say life is like a journey. Now that's an old simile. Life is like a journey. But your life, sometimes that your journey goes through some very painful, difficult times. It's just like you're on the bus and the bus goes through some very ugly territory. And what do you do when life is difficult? You want to get out and solve the problem as quick as possible to get out of that suffering. So when the bus is driving through some very, very difficult, ugly territory, what I call the nuclear waste dumps of life, the toxic areas, the gasworks, the old industrial areas, which are not very scenic at all, you tell your bus driver, accelerate, put your feet down on the pedal and get out of here as quickly as possible. But what happens mostly in your life when you're suffering, the suffering tends to last longer than it should. Your bus driver of your journey tends to slow down, even stop when it's ugly, bad territory. And then later on in the journey of your life, you have happy times. Beautiful, wonderful times like this retreat. And you tell the bus driver, slow down. I want to enjoy this. I want to linger as long as possible. And what does your bus driver do? Accelerate. The happy times don't last as long as they should. And you think it's because my bus driver is stupid. My will needs to be trained to be more wise, so I can get rid of the painful moments of my life, so they don't last so long. And when I'm happy, I can stay in that happiness longer and longer. All I need to do is to train my bus driver. Your will. And that's what many people do. They come to do mindfulness courses. They go to churches or temples. They're trying to lessen their suffering and increase their happiness by training their will to be smart, to make better decisions. And they never achieve anything. Until one day they find, well, if I'm going to teach this bus driver the will to make smart decisions instead of all the stupid decisions you've made in your life, you've got to find that bus driver first of all. Find its seat. Find where the bus driver actually sits in your consciousness, in your mind. And that's what you do in meditation. Until you finally find the bus driver's seat, and that's where you get the greatest insight, shocking insight. The bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. You're on automatic. And what happens next when you realize the bus driver's seat is empty? Non-self. No will there. No person just driving your bus. You know, no one there, and the result of that is you go back to your seat and you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to. You make a right decision, a wrong decision. Not my fault, nothing to do with me. No one there. So you enjoy the journey of life with no greed, no negativity, the defilements of God. Happiness, suffering, oh, it's all part of the journey. And you don't complain to the bus driver anymore. That's what happens. That's finding out anatta. And when you realize that there's no one in control of this, oh, freedom at last. That's why one of Ajahn Chah's famous little stories, that it comes from a statue which is in a monastery in the south of Thailand. I don't know actually where this monk got the statue from, but it's a statue of a monk holding his arms up in ecstasy. Just a newly enlightened monk, the statue. And the caption underneath is, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. Yes, I love that one. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. So I don't have to keep searching for it. And there's nothing wrong with me that I'm not happy. I can be free at last. Not trying to get rid of unhappiness and go and search for happiness. Joy at last. To know there's no happiness in the world. If you understand that, you understand the Four Noble Truths. So, it is very true that you are not in control of your body and mind. So who is in control? Who has been brainwashing you for the last 4 or 5 days? So this is actually how you get enlightened. You need to be brainwashed by somebody else. I've got to get into your head and I've got to say, let go. Because you can't let go. If you let go, you're doing something. But if I tell you to let go, you can. And when I tell you to let go, you get very peaceful, surprisingly. Not all of you, not all at once, but many of you get just a few moments sitting here not doing anything. Peace at last. Why do you do that? It's because I have suggested that. Where did I get it from? Ajahn Chah. He brainwashed me. Who brainwashed Ajahn Chah? Ajahn Mun. Who brainwashed Ajahn Chah? You go all the way back. The Buddha. Who brainwashed the Buddha? That was Kassapa the Buddha. Who brainwashed Kassapa the Buddha? Probably the previous Buddha. It goes back and back and back and back and back and back. Without end. Because sometimes people say, well, where did it all begin? And I would like putting this up during these talks. A bit of physics. Because sometimes people ask, it's not this question, it's another question. Where did all this world begin, the universe begin? Because that's what you're asked by the Christians. And the Christian says, well, you have to have something like a God, a supernatural principle to start all of this. So do Buddhists believe in God? And of course, the problem is, if there's a first cause which started everything, well, what caused the first cause? It just puts, well, they say, it kicks the can down the road. That's the usual explanation these days, the metaphor. It doesn't really answer the problem. So how can we have a beginning of things? And the answer comes from something I learned in Einstein's general theory of relativity. Don't worry, it's very simple. The universe in which we live, with all these galaxies, and I think you've probably read enough books or seen enough documentaries on the TV to get some idea of this universe in which we live and how huge it is. 14 billion light years from edge to edge. But you have probably imagined, like I used to imagine as a kid, where does this universe end? And when you get to the end of the universe, how can that end of the universe actually be? Is there a wall there? in a brick wall saying, end of universe, you can't go any further? Or is it one of these razor wire fences like I see in Singapore with a picture of being someone being shot, military area, you can't go any further? Or is it just this chasm of emptiness afterwards? Does the universe have an end to it? And the answer is it doesn't have any end to it. This universe in space has no edge to it. But it's not infinite. It's a finite volume with no beginning, no end, no edges to it at all. How can that be? And it was explained, I remember, a very simple explanation. Imagine a soccer ball. And imagine a little ant crawling on that soccer ball. It goes round and round and round. It can never find a beginning or an end to the soccer ball. But that soccer ball has got a finite area. It doesn't go on forever. It's not infinite, but it has no edges to it. And that's how it was described to me. I remember in Cambridge about this universe. It's like that, the soccer ball. It curves in on itself. It goes round and round. So it's a finite volume, this universe in which we live. We know how big it is. But it's got no beginning, no end, no edges to it. Now that is very common for people with some science to understand that. So now let's extend it somewhere else. Time. Time is limited. It's only got a finite duration. But it has no beginning and no end. No edge to time. Just like the universe. And there you find the answer to the God question. You don't need a God because not even time has a beginning. Just like the soccer ball. You can walk and walk and walk and walk and walk and walk. Like this universe. Finite volume. But no edges. No beginning. No end. Simple. So now you know the meaning of the universe. I don't know, what was the question I was asking anyway? Totally out of sync with the question. What was it? Oh yeah, about brainwashing you. So that's very true. This is what happens. It's so nice to know the world doesn't belong to me. So I take no responsibility. I remember one of the first time I gave a talk like this. You know, I said the reason why I tell very bad jokes. And the reason I tell very bad jokes is because my father told very bad jokes. And he brainwashed me. So it's not my fault. But I remember just one of the stories he said. He came home one day and he said one of his friends had a really, really, really bad time. He had an accident on a motorbike. And now motorbike accidents can be really bad. And so taken to hospital, had to have his leg amputated. This was quite a few years ago. And it happens, you know, that they took off the wrong leg. You know, it's actually really true. I've seen this in hospital, actually, these days. Even modern, technologically advanced hospitals actually get a felt tip pen and say, this one, before they send them into the surgery. You know, so everybody knows which one they're supposed to cut off. So as soon as they realised the mistake, rushed back into surgery again to cut the other one off. He lost both his legs. And of course, as soon as he could, he got a lawyer and he sued that hospital. But he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. And I remember my father telling that joke. Bad jokes. But what can I do? He brainwashed me. So I take no responsibility. And so we have this talk up in our library somewhere. It's why Ajahn Brahm tells bad jokes. It's all about non-self and the will and anatta and brainwashing. So if you hang around here long enough, you'll start telling bad jokes too. And I've always noticed that people say, that's a terrible joke. And then I found him telling it to somebody else afterwards. Anyway, if a man had an affair, how shall the woman determine whether to forgive and continue or leave and end the relationship with her boyfriend or husband? Why is it always men have affairs? Do girls not have affairs? Of course they do. If it's a man, there must be a woman at the other end, unless it's a gay affair. But that sometimes could happen. So how can the woman determine whether to forgive and continue? Now, first of all, you got to find out, you know, the truth of the matter. Because sometimes women think the guys are having an affair, and they're not, they're just suspicion. Sometimes, you know, that it might mean that, look, there was, oh, this, I just, well, no, I better not say this, because maybe you know these people. That sometimes, that, you know, you actually ask, why is my wife having an affair with someone? Is it something about me? I always remember this. This is another story comes up about a marriage counsellor over in Singapore. She said this story. It's a brilliant, brilliant counsellor. There was this woman in Singapore. She was sure her husband was having an affair. Always coming home late, never interested in her at all. So she went to see the marriage counsellor and said, look, I want to get rid of my husband. I want to divorce him. And the counsellor, she was very smart. She said, well, look, does he love you right now? He said, no, probably not. So if you divorce him, he'll be really happy. Is that what you want? He said, no, no, I don't want him to be happy. That's the last thing I want. He said, well, look, try this. Because, you know, he fell in love with you once. Now go and get a nice hairstyle. Get some sexy clothes. Put some makeup and scent on. You know, look, you know, make yourself a bit more attractive. And then to see if you can make him fall in love with you again. And once he's fallen in love with you again, then divorce him. He said, yeah, I'm going to do that. What a good plan. So, you know, she went to get sort of a fashionable hairstyle, you know, started to wear some sexy clothes again, and then started to, you know, wear makeup and stuff. And the... the marriage counsellor would check up on her, you know, every week. You know, she'd come, how's it going? He said, it's actually working. He's coming home earlier. And he's becoming, you know, a bit more sort of affectionate towards me. He said, great, is he love you? No, not yet. So keep on going. So she kept on with the nice new clothes, you know, a new outfit every week, and nice hair and fashionable stuff. And then after many weeks, she stopped coming to the counsellor. So the counsellor called her and said, what's going on? I haven't seen you for 2 or 3 weeks. He said, oh, no, it's okay. He said, well, how is he? Is he coming home? Yeah, he's coming home really early now. And is he affectionate? Yeah, he's so affectionate to me now. Has he fallen in love with you? Yes, he has. Great, now's the time to divorce him. Oh, no. He's so nice now. And the counsellor said, mission accomplished. That was the plan from the very beginning. Have a wonderful life together. Because that's what the counsellor wanted. She was just trying to stay to hurt him and make him fall in love with you first and then divorce him. But she knew that once that happened, she'd have her husband back and have a wonderful life. So sometimes, you know, if someone has, you know, they're having an affair, just why? Why can't they have an affair with you? That's what wives are there for. You know, a man is supposed to have the affair with the wives, not the other way around. Or wives with the husband. So sometimes, you know, the wife and husband has to take a look at themselves and just, well, how are you dressing? You're becoming really sloppy with your dress now and your hair and everything else. A lot of times you are, and you look in the mirror and say, crikey, who would go out with you? So, you know, just, I'm a monk, I'm a man, I know just how you can attract men, how you attract girls. How do you attract girls? You know, they like gifts and stuff like that. I think I would, I didn't tell you that story about the man who's, you'll see, Valentine's Day. Did I tell that Valentine's Day story? Day before Valentine's Day. And the husband asked his wife, darling, what would you like for Valentine's Day? And she said, oh, nothing, darling, I don't mind, I don't want these gift things. If you're a man, you know that's not what she means. She wants something. So he asked again, oh, come on, come on, I want to get you a present. What do you want? Oh, well, okay, darling. Something with diamonds in. That's what girls like, diamonds. So he said, okay, darling. And next day she received a nice little present. She opened it up, and it was a pack of playing cards. Has 13 diamonds in it. What are you asking? That's what you wanted. Obviously, that's a course for divorce. So, first of all, that if you really want the relationship to carry on, put some effort and energy and work on it. It's amazing how sometimes you can get it back together again. That's why a counsellor will get the two of them together. Look, you two, do you really want to sort of get it back together again? So a good counsellor will just say, well, it's up to you. You can work, you can get it going again if you want to. Do you really want to? What's the problem? But of course there's some times when people just move apart. You know, their interests and everything, just basically the relationship's over. Because that happens sometimes. You know, it's impermanence. You know, anicca, what we talk about in Buddhism, it doesn't always last forever. You know, some relationships, you know, last a long time, some a short time. It's just nature. So if it does start to not work out and you separate, it's natural. Don't think that someone is to blame. Oh, why did I do that? I could have been better. Or more often, why did that bastard do that? They're a terrible person. I don't. Why did I ever marry them? I must have been crazy to go out with such a guy. And we get all this anger at other people, or anger towards ourselves. You should never do that. It's just life. It happens sometimes. So, you know, don't sort of blame anybody. It's, you know, when the affair, the marriage ends or whatever, the relationship ends, no blame. It's just nature, that's all. Now that stops a lot of the suffering. Which means, you know, thank you for all the wonderful time we spent together. Had some great memories. Thank you so much. You know, it's over. Let it go. There's always another sort of buzz coming behind the one you just got off. If you want another relationship, you can have another relationship. It's really up to you. So never think you're too old either for a relationship. In the modern age, you know, you get these people 60, 70 years of age. You know, they start again, they get married. It's incredible just to see just how people, yeah, we want to spend a bit more life together, why not? So that's wonderful when that happens. And so, you know, next time try and get someone with the same interests as you. I just was thinking about this couple. I read about this and it just made me laugh for weeks. You know, that this, they've got clubs for everything these days. And they have like this Walt Disney club. You know, people who really like the characters of Walt Disney. And this was in England where they're really eccentric. So there was one guy, he was so obsessed with Walt Disney that, you know, legally he changed his name to Mr. Mouse. First name Mickey. And imagine you go up to the bank and say, you know, what's your name? Mickey Mouse. But he's got the driver's license, the passport, you know. He is Mickey Mouse. He actually changed it. You can do that if you want to. So he was such an aficionado of Walt Disney movies, he actually changed his name to Mickey Mouse. And of course, the inevitable happened. In the Walt Disney Club, he married a woman who was just exactly the mirror opposite of him. That's right. She had actually changed her name to Mrs. Mouse. First name Minnie. And when they met each other, what's your name, Mickey Mouse? What's your name, Minnie Mouse? And it was real. They had actually changed their name. And of course, you know, it has to happen. They fell in love. And after they fell in love, they actually, in an Anglican church, Christian church in England, they got married. And I don't know how the priest could actually in front of everyone, do you, Mickey Mouse, like Minnie Mouse, to be your Lord with it. That poor priest, I don't know how he could actually do that without rolling in the aisle of the church laughing. But it actually happened. Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse got married and lived happily ever after. It's in the newspapers. I like reading the, I don't like reading about the wars and the scandals and the, these are the things I really love reading. That's really worthwhile reading newspapers to find stories like that. So, you know, if you go and, you know, if you had an separation, find people who like the same things as you. And it's much easier then to sort of have a good relationship. So, but anyway, that if you want, you know, if you want to forgive and continue, that needs a bit of a counsellor to be in front of you, like a somebody, because you can't really say that yourself. You need actually people to actually to look inside of you, train counsellors and say, well, you know, I think it's the case that you do really want to carry on. And then to help you carry on. Again, it's really nice sometimes being a monk, because sometimes you can be that counsellor and get people to actually to forgive and continue on. And there's many people like that. There's one girl, she comes every week to our monastery now with her husband. She caught him actually going to prostitutes instead of, almost worse than an affair. But when she caught him, she dragged him to see me up in Bodhinyana Monastery. We talked for a long, long, long time. It was obvious, you know, he still loved his wife. But, you know, basically she wasn't giving him enough sex, so he went to the prostitutes. So, you know, it was a bit of her fault as well. And, you know, you talked to both of them, and I made him promise in front of me and in front of the Buddha that he would never, ever, ever do that again. And then once he promised that, I made his wife forgive him. I'll give him a chance. So what I usually say is, put them on parole. Oh no, not parole, probation. Probation for a year. Until they have to make sure that they fulfill, you know, their vows. Because you can't trust him yet. But give him probation and see if he can win that trust back. And he did that. And the two of them always come every week to feed the monks. Out of gratitude for getting their marriage back together again. And they're much happier together than they would be apart. Now he made a big mistake and there's some reason behind that. So, you know, but he said, no, I just really want this marriage to work. So, you know, okay, please forgive me. And I'll never, ever, 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 ever do that again. So sometimes that can be done. Individual cases, you can't say the same works with everybody, but sometimes it's good to give someone some forgiveness if there is still a relationship worth saving there. We all make mistakes sometimes. Okay, shall I make my confession now? Many years ago, I spent some of the happiest hours of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. True? Don't spoil it, don't spoil it. We kissed and hugged. She was married to someone else. I loved that woman so much. She was another man's wife. You've read this story before, so you know what's coming. That woman was my mother. It was my father's wife. We spent some of the happiest hours of life kissing, hugging, loving each other to bits. The first time I said that, I remember saying that in Malabar, and oh, people were just so shocked. But then afterwards, when I told them the punchline, they laughed their heads off in relief, I think, more than anything else. Anyway, my goodness, I'm going over time again. Is there any way of preventing choking on my own saliva during meditation? It does not happen often, but once in a while, sweat saliva somehow results in choking. Yes, it's. If you can ask Dani, oh, where's Dani? She's here, she's gone. Okay, I'll show him back there. That you can get these little machines from the dentist, you know, the little thing right here. So if you can borrow one of those when you're meditating, you have no problem with the saliva. Very easy. So get the saliva sucker going. No, just swallow and then you're done with it. Now, this is a very wise question. You are the greatest teacher in this world, and you must be the Maitreya Buddha on earth. Thank you for teaching and setting up this wonderful retreat center for us. My question is, how to handle the daily life in the water after the frog has realized dry land. The mission of the frog is to help more frogs realize dry land. Yeah, sort of. But anyway, whoever wrote that is obviously very wise. You shouldn't actually mention about personalities. So, no, a good monk has to be humble. And I am the most humble monk in the whole world. My humility knows no bounds. And I am trying to go into the Guinness Book of Records as the most humblest monk. Very good. It is a must to go through each jhana one by one. Can we skip and go directly to third or fourth jhana if we practice a lot? Why do you always want the shortcuts? Now, if you understand, remember that simile I gave of the lotus? The fourth jhana is right in the middle of the third jhana. So the third jhana opens up and there's a fourth jhana inside. That third jhana itself is in the middle of the second jhana. The second jhana opens and inside is the third. The second jhana is in the middle of the first jhana. The first jhana is right inside you right now. You just need to open it up. And there it is. So there is no other way. You have to go through 1, 2, 3, 4. You can go through it quickly. But you have to go that way. You have to open the lotus up. There's no other way to get to the middle of the lotus than go open up all the leaves in sequence. There's no other way to get there. So yeah, you do have to go through one after another. When you realize there's no willpower, will the nimitta fade away? Thank you. Actually, no, the nimitta is much easier. When there's no willpower, you tend not to do so much. All this thing about you think that you can achieve these stages of enlightenment, that you do things, all of that sort of delusion falls away, so you just sit there and do nothing. And that's when all these things happen to you. I haven't told this simile yet of Ajahn Chah, but it's a great simile. I've said it before, many of you know it. It's a simile of his monastery, Wat Pa Phong. He said it was a mango orchard. And he said, as a simile, those trees were all planted by the Buddha. And it's only a simile. And he said, now all those trees, they're full of ripe, sweet, juicy mangoes. And he said, you monks, you don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to shake the tree to get a mango to fall, nor to actually throw up a stick to get the mango. If you do any of those things, you'll get nothing. All you need to do to get a mango is to sit perfectly still under the tree and hold out your hand, and a mango will fall. And I remember that simile in my very first few weeks staying with Ajahn Chah. And I forgot that for years because I thought it was so stupid. I had no way I could understand it. And I always thought, like many of you, you have to put forth effort. You've got to strive and struggle to get anything in life, especially in meditation. It's only after many years of struggling and getting nowhere and learning, what my teacher kept on talking to me, but I was too stupid to take it in, to realize, no, if you really want to get the deep meditations and enlightenment, just sit very still under the Bodhi tree. Don't shake it. Don't climb and throw sticks up. And open up your heart. And then all these amazing things, they just fall into you. That's actually how it happens. It's such a perfect simile from one of the greatest teachers of the last century. Sit under the Bodhi tree, perfectly still, open up your heart, and all these jhanas, enlightenment, the whole works just falls into your hand. You go and shake the tree, climb up it, throw things up, you get absolutely nothing. And that's what many people do for years. Try and shake jhanas out of their mind. Climb and do something to make it work. And you always get frustrated. Until one day you either give up, or you're smart enough just to sit there and just be still. And all these things come to you. That is what meditation is. Ajahn Chah, brilliant teacher. So fortunate to have spent time with him. As lay Buddhists, we more or less would like to have some worldly pleasures like wealth, good relationships, family, and so on. I sometimes have internal conflicts. On the one hand, I have to be honest to myself that I still crave for these worldly pleasures. But on the other hand, Buddhists are told to let go of these so as to be free. How can I be free with these conflicts? How can we both be both true to ourselves and be a good Buddhist at the same time? Thank you. Excellent. Someone is being honest to themselves, which is important. Of course, this is how you feel, and so you will have your sex, you will have your noodles in the evening, you want to watch the television, all sorts of other stuff. That's the nature. So be kind and be honest to yourself. But you'll find there's, you know, the reason why you're here is that's not really enough for you in life. A lot of you have seen through those pleasures and say, well, you know, I've had the sex, I've had the kids, I've had the relationships, and some of you had the wealth. It's maybe not as much as you would want, but you've had enough to, you know, get these things which you wanted. Is this all there is? And this is one of the reasons why you see, you know, people like the monks and the nuns, you know, they've got no family, they don't have sex, and they don't have these so-called worldly pleasures, but they seem to be happiest of all. And that's really, really strange. Why is it these monks are happy? And then you come along to these retreats and you start learning about meditation, you have a taste of freedom. And this is actually where you start to get interested. You don't give up all the pleasures all the way, you don't do anything, it just happens. As you meditate more and more, as you hang around monks like me more and more, you tend to get not so interested in wealth, not so interested in even sex and stuff. Okay, you do your duties to your husband and wife, but it's not such a huge thing in your life anymore. And then the wealth doesn't become such a huge thing. Like fame is just, what I always wanted to be famous and well known, and now sort of, what for? So as you practice more and more, naturally those things which drove you in the world tend to have less and less meaning. And things like meditation, things like kindness, generosity are more important than wealth and fame. It just happens naturally. You can't make it happen. You can't stop it happening. It's just a natural progression. So be honest to where you are and don't compare yourself. If you still like the movies and the TV and the sex, please go ahead. But after a while, if you hang around and do more meditation, you find those interests get less and you start to transform. But don't think that one person is better than another. No more than I keep on saying that a person who's, say, you know, in grade 12 is better than one in grade 1, or say someone in the sixth form, you know, in the English way of doing things, is better than in primary school. You can't say one is better than the other. One person's been in school longer, that's all. That's why they're at university and why they understand more about maths than someone in primary school. They're not better. So don't ever think, oh, the monks and nuns, you know, they're more enlightened, therefore we're better than you. Yeah, there comes the time you're sitting up here. I hope I'm not sitting down there, but... but, you know, you find that does happen after a while. So never actually compare a person with another person. And at the same time, you realize that this is just a path, it's a process. And having been a monk for such a long time, I've seen people at the beginning of the process and see them develop, and it's very inspiring for me to see that. Especially, you know, seeing people you've ordained as monks and seeing them grow. They start off as these little anagarikas helping out in the kitchen, the people in white, there's a few of them sitting in the back there. And you start to teaching them, ordain them, and little by little they get brainwashed, and then after a while you get like an Ajahn Brahmali. He's become a teacher now. You know, it's like he's my kid. So I'm really proud of my children. Just like fathers are proud of their kids when they do well in life. That's my boy. So it's nice when you see things like that and see other people. Like this monk laughing over here. When he first became a monk, sort of his family really objected. I remember him saying a letter, he wanted to go visit his family in Trondheim in Norway. I remember the letter you showed me, he said, you can come back as long as you wear trousers. Remember that letter? And I told him to write back and say, Mum, Dad, I will come back either in robes or naked, but no trousers. Make your choice. Because his family were really against him being a monk. But you know, he's old enough to make his decision, he became a monk. And then I also remember him when his father died. You know, you went off to look after the funeral. I hope you don't mind me saying this, but I'm proud of these things. You should be proud too. His brother, his elder brother, sent me this letter. And he said, "We never wanted our brother to become a monk, but now having seen how he's changed and how strong he was in one of the most difficult times in our family, the father dying, I say thank you for all you've taught him. And he has full approval from our family to become a monk. We're so proud of him now." And it's wonderful when you see something like that happen. Now, as a teacher, that makes me really, really happy. You know, when you can see people actually developing as from the lay life into being monks. Really wonderful. And you see, it's a process. So, you know, they start off, you know, the Anagarikas, all rough and wet-eared. And maybe that's what they say, you know, but in the end you see the whole process work, and you know, many of them become great monks, and also now you see that with the nuns as well. Great women, you know, starting off as just little ladies who come to the monastery and just like you, sitting here meditating, and then they get this faith, they decide, yeah, let's go and do it, become bhikkhunis, and they become inspirations for the world. It's a whole process which has been going on since the time of the Buddha. So it's not that you decide, right, I'm going to let go of all my sensory pleasures. You're honest to what you have. And then, just like Venerable Mudita the other day, who's one of our monks, he said, "Oh, I want to go into town this afternoon because I've got some shopping to do for the monastery, you know, with one of the Anagarikas." I said, "Oh, I can go in lunch." No, I want to go before lunch, you know, and get some food in town. And I said, "That is because you don't want to eat here. You want to get what you like in your favourite restaurant." And he said, "Yes, exactly." And I said, "Well done, honest, you can go." As long as people are honest with their defilements and their cravings and stuff. You know, he's fed up with the cold food we get. You know, so he wanted something hot. So fair enough, you know, just going a bit early. And then the Anagara can get him something hot to eat, what he likes, in his cafe or something. He's being honest. And that is much more important to me, you know, than say, "Oh, no, it's just, you know, I have to go in because the shops aren't open until this time or that time." So, you know, if you've got your defilements, you know, just do it for goodness sake. Be honest. Honesty is more important than more anything else. I better carry on, go quick, because it's half past 9 o'clock. Uh-oh. Handika, this is in Bahasa. Okay, anyway, this is a Bahasa question. But first of all, dear Ajahn, would you please share your thoughts how meditation practice would impact on the development of illness related to dementia, including Alzheimer's? Thank you. It is, I'm pretty sure, it hasn't been proven yet, but someone who meditates is very unlikely to get dementia or Alzheimer's. I know many old monks. And those old monks don't seem to get dementia or Alzheimer's, the ones who practice meditation anyway. Haven't done the research, haven't done the statistics yet, but I'm pretty sort of sure, just by my feelings and anecdotal evidence, that you don't get dementia. But there's something I remember Ajahn Chah saying. I mentioned it before, but it comes up now. If you want to have a healthy body, you have to exercise it. If you want to have a strong mind, you have to keep it still. The opposite of exercise. So when I hear people say, "Oh no, if you want to stave off dementia, you know, you've got to do Sudoku puzzles, do crosswords, be active, think a lot." And I think that's wrong. I think that by just exercising your mind like that, you do wear it out. It'd be wonderful to actually to see if stillness gives more energy to the mind, and that goes into the brain, and you don't get dementia. Interesting. There's a little proposition, a hypothesis, coming from a great meditator like Ajahn Chah. So anyway, here we go. Okay. The story of the man who went to see the doctor. This is one of the Ajahn Brahm's stupid jokes again. And the doctor said, "We got two things very wrong with you. The first is you've got cancer." He said, "Oh no, not cancer. What's the other one?" And the second is, you've got dementia, Alzheimer's disease. And he said, well, at least I haven't got cancer. Okay, that's a joke. Yeah. He's got cancer, they said, first of all. And then he's got Alzheimer's, so he keeps forgetting. Okay, never mind. I'll read it out. Apaka kekika kesika. No, come on. Handika, please. Very good, here we go. You can read it and Handicap can hear it. And I've got to think of a story which, how to be compassionate to people who are suffering. Yeah? Yeah, go on. Okay. Okay, when awareness develops, you have more energy. When you have more energy, you don't need to sleep so much. And also, I shouldn't tell you this, but I'm going to tell you now, you don't need to eat so much either. I'm sorry, but that's what happens. The reason is you don't need so much petrol in the car. You don't need to take your car to be serviced when it doesn't hardly ever leave the garage. So if you use your body and mind a lot, and when you're not mindful, you think about all sorts of things, your poor brain will get very tired. So it will need more sleep. If you're peaceful and still, you don't need so much sleep. It takes a while because you've got to catch up, first of all, in your sleep. But after you've been here a few days, you'll notice yourself waking up earlier in the morning, naturally. And if you wake up early in the morning, get up. And you can get up and you try some meditation. You know, don't look at the clock. The trick is, I tell this to the monks, get up first before you look at the clock. If you look at the clock first, you never get up. So you get up and then you look at the clock. Oh God, it's only 2 o'clock in the morning. Just meditate. You can, you know, see what happens. You might get into really, really nice meditation. And if you don't, you get tired. You can always go to bed afterwards. So that's why we have this free and easy schedule over here. So you don't need to be afraid that, you know, oh, if I get up now, I'm going to be tired for the rest of the day. You can always catch up if you get it wrong, but give it a try. And you'll notice that, yeah, when you do meditation naturally, you won't need to sleep so much. It always has to be naturally. Don't do it by force. Okay, so that's natural. The story teaches how to be compassionate to people, like people who talk too much, leave messages everywhere, and how to appreciate goodness in them. Okay, this is a story of someone who was snoring in the meditation hall. There's always people snore in the meditation hall. And don't think it's not you. Because we can't hear our own snoring, but other people can. So anyway, this was in our city centre in Nolamara one day. And this girl, when I was giving a talk, she lay down, fell fast asleep and started snoring really loudly, and people woke her up. And when they woke her up, I told the people who woke her up off, because I knew that girl. She talked to me beforehand. She was going through some very severe domestic abuse from her husband. Not just shouting at her, but hitting her. And she was so terrified, you know, of being in the house. And please don't think, oh, you go to the police. Sometimes when you're in that situation, you can't think straight. You're so confused. You know, it's easy for us to say, well, just get out of the house, get some friends, call the police, it's against the law. But if you're right in the middle of that situation as a wife, you just don't know what to do. So she came to our temple And when she came to our temple, she felt, you know, safe. And it was a kind place. And for the first time in I don't know how many weeks, she felt so safe that she decided to lay down. And she fell fast asleep because she hadn't slept for days on end. And when people woke up, I said, what did you do that for? That poor girl needed sleep so much and you just spoilt it for her. So when you realize why a person does that, why they went to sleep in the middle of the hall and started snoring, when you realize where it comes from, you think, oh, please, go to sleep again. I'll get you a pillow. Do you want a blanket? I'll tuck you in when I jump arms giving the talk. Because you understand where it's coming from. You have compassion. So if someone bangs the door, you don't know why they do it. There may be some reason you don't understand. Just like that woman who was under severe domestic abuse. And she had a safe place and she fell asleep. So next time, please let that happen. You don't know why people do things. They have their reasons. So please let them do it. So if they make a noise, the best they can possibly do. You don't know where they come from. The very fact that they can come on this retreat, they've had the courage to actually to come and do some meditation. Wonderful. Please don't scare them off. Now that's the best they can do. And what they're doing, maybe not as good as you can do, but it's the best they can do. So wonderful. Well done. Yes. Okay, you checked online.
MRI studies that shows the effects of meditation on degenerative disease, including Alzheimer's and dementia. Further research is needed to support that, but there is research on that. So, yes.
So, it's going to work. So, but that really disappoints me. Because I was hoping that people who meditate do get a little bit of dementia, and forget the joke I told them yesterday, because they're going to get it again tomorrow. There's only a certain number of jokes and stories I have, and so I was hoping that old people will forget them. So when I go to Hong Kong or go to Indonesia next time, I can tell the same old story and the same old joke, and you won't remember it. So, oh, that's really new, because you've got dementia in the meantime. Okay, so thank you all for listening, because now we're going to Paul Handiklas to translate all this into Bahasa for those who can't understand English. So, but for tomorrow, yeah?
Sorry, can I ask a little bit of question?
Yeah, okay. Yes, yeah. Yes.
What is the best way we as a friend to support her?
Okay, you have an abusive husband, how can you support her? You know, if it's very abusive like that, you know, you need sort of sometimes to get her away to a refuge, because it can kill her sometimes. It can cause huge psychological and physical damage to her. That's why in many countries it's illegal. The guy goes to jail if he treats a wife like that. And so you've got to be very careful there to protect her physical well-being. And of course the other thing is you need a counsellor there. Now there's also another thing which I've noticed, that sometimes that the husband, the guy, doesn't think he's being abusive at all. He can't see it. So one great thing to be able to do today, get out your smartphone and video him when he's acting sort of abusive or violently. And then when he's settled down, play it to him. It's like a mindfulness technique, because when we're really angry, we just don't know what we're doing. It may be that he's drunk. Take a video of the person when they're drunk. When they're sober, play it to them. And that's a huge wake-up call. Say, is that what I'm like? I remember the first time that doing the training to be a school teacher. No, we all had to present a lesson. It didn't really matter what we were doing. And it was videoed. It was the first time I saw what I looked like you know, on a TV screen. It's just a private video. And that shocked me, you know, because where you're standing now, you know, you're looking through your eyes, but, you know, you can't see what I can see now. I'm seeing your face. And to actually to see yourself on TV for the first time, actually you start, the reason I did that, because if you've got any small idiosyncrasy, you know, like a twitch, and you in the front of high school kids, after 5 minutes all the kids will be in front of you. So you have to get that out of your system before the kids tease you with it. So, if you can video him, or get the wife to video him, when he's drunk or abusive, and play it back to him. Sometimes you don't realize how bad we are. And when he sees that, sometimes that can be the wake-up call, the thing which is needed, to get him so embarrassed and upset about himself, that I don't want to be this person I've seen on a video. I didn't realize that's what I look like. That's a very good technique if you can manage that. But other than that, you need counselors.
So how if the wife is in denial, like my husband is angry, he says sometimes, he says,
yeah, again, you know, she has bruises on her body. You know, she didn't fall down the stairs. She didn't walk into a door. That was her husband. And you know, it does kill people. And if it doesn't kill them, it has such huge psychological damage for the rest of their life. They do get into very, very bad states. And again, that's the job of countries, you know, to actually advertise so the women realize it is a problem. And the men realize it's a problem as well. And it's not just men, it's women as well. And I have a little article which was showing around to the monks that research, I think it was done in Europe, and they showed that nagging wives actually kill the husbands. It's true, it's there. I'll get it out and read it tomorrow for you. It's recent research. They say something like 350 deaths out of 100,000 are caused by nagging wives. It actually does lessen the husband's lifespan. But the opposite doesn't, apparently. The husband nags at the wife, you're immune to it, apparently. But not the men. So, you know, you actually kill them. So, you know, there's domestic abuse on both sides. So, you know, be kind to each other. But if you do see that, you've got to stop it pretty quickly. And obviously the best thing is to stop it before it gets so ingrained. Early prevention is the best. But, you know, if not, then you know, you have to convince her, you know, that, you know, this is a problem. You can't carry on like this. Videos is pretty good. If she's got some bruises, take photos of them. Show it to her again and again and again. Look, this is what you look like. You know, that's not from a door, that's from your husband. Otherwise, you know, see the terrible things which happened in India. They kill the girls, they pour acid over them, all sorts of incredibly bad things. And that's, you know, that's when it goes really, really too far. That is unacceptable. Anyway, that's getting serious stuff. And I wanted to send you off in a nice, happy way. So, with actually the dementia thing, now my mother suffered dementia for 2 or 3 years. And I remember one wonderful experience when my brother and I went to see my mother in the dementia ward. And there is always some positives with everything. And what we saw was, as we walked into the ward, we saw my mother, and my brother, who was looking after her, said straight away, "Hey, that's not your mother's dress that she's wearing. She was wearing somebody else's dress." And then he sort of laughed to himself. He said, "Oh, sorry, I should have remembered. This happens all the time." Because if everybody in this ward has dementia, they don't remember which dress belongs to whom. So they just see a dress in someone's room. If they like it, they put it on and wear it. And isn't that sort of wonderful? You know, it's sharing. When you have dementia, you don't have any sense of ownership. So that would be wonderful if all the women sort of had dementia, they wouldn't have to buy so many dresses. You just go into somebody else's bedroom, oh, that's a nice dress, and you just wear it, and they go into your bedroom, wear some of your dresses, which means you wouldn't have to buy so many because you're sharing more of them. How many dresses can you wear at one time? So that's a wonderful thing. So if you've got dementia, when you go out of here, if you like a pair of shoes, you don't like your own, oh, that's okay, I'll have those ones to walk back this evening. So that was one nice thing about dementia. You lose your sense of ownership, which is beautiful. But please don't do that, otherwise we get into trouble. And please don't go into my room and wear my dress. Okay, enough. Sadhu.